As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to the first game podcast of the 2015-16 season. Did you miss us? Of course you did. And I'm sure you were all up to fun things over the summer. I know for a fact Julian was busy throwing urine at Chris Froome. Is that correct?
Yes, me and all my family.
There you go. While wearing your berets and carrying baguettes, yes?
Exactly.
I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and in the studio this week, as you've probably guessed, I am joined by Julian Lawrence, Stuart Robson, and Rory K. Smith. Welcome to a new season, gentlemen. And let's get straight into it.
Cresswell making the run forward outside him. Coquelin hasn't been able to bring the ball away cleanly. Oxlade-Chamberlain couldn't clear either. It's Zarate. Oh, he's crept in. Cech beaten at his near post. And West Ham have doubled their lead.
So let's start at the Emirates, where Arsenal start with a defeat just like 2 years ago against Swansea when everybody was shouting Wenger out. But Stuart, nobody was shouting Wenger out on Sunday. They were just kind of shell-shocked. Or maybe you were shouting Wenger out, but you were a minority of one.
No, I mean, Arsenal didn't play at all well, and still the same old problems lie defensively. When the ball comes into the box, they were holding too high a line. There's too much space between the defenders and the goalkeeper. Arsene Wenger said afterwards that he knew before the cross came in they were going to be in trouble. So why didn't they get a better defensive line? Why didn't they attack the ball when it came into the box? I don't think Arsenal are going to have a problem this season. They're still going to be there or thereabouts. I think it was a one-off game for them. They looked tired. They looked as though they couldn't quite open up West Ham. And West Ham played very well. But I think over the coming weeks, we'll see that Arsenal is still a good side.
I want to detour a little bit and introduce a concept. Somebody at some point, and I have no idea who, but maybe you guys can tell me, said that having Peter Cech is worth an extra 10 points in the course of a season.
Everyone's trying to say something like that.
Right. We haven't found sort of patient zero who we can blame for this bit of complete nonsense.
I think maybe Christophe Lolichon, goalkeeping coach, might have said something like that on French radio, something like, with him you're sure that he's sent 10 to 12 points.
Has Lolichon moved to Arsenal?
No.
To babysit Cech? What does he do?
No.
Does he live in Cech's house and secretly train him?
No, but they're very close. They're still very close.
What's Lolichon doing now?
He's still at Chelsea.
Seriously, he's not for long, right?
Well, I don't think for long, but okay. I don't think he's going to come to Arsenal, though. Yeah.
Well, the reason I bring this up, because I was speaking to one of those sort of analytics types, but it doesn't really take an analytic type to figure this out. In an average season, a goalkeeper will make something like 250 to 300 saves, right? Now, out of those, there are many saves that, you know, there's no goalkeeper in the world would get to, and others which every goalkeeper in the world would get to. Especially if you're on a good team, it's extremely unlikely that you're going to pull off enough amazing saves that it's going to be worth 10 to 12 points. It's just an absolute nonsense.
De Gea last season did pretty well in terms of winning points for
that
United.
That is true, but I always think when that happens that it's treated as though that no other goalkeeper in the world could have saved that. Now, there were some brilliant saves. De Gea was the best keeper in the league. But it's not like it's either De Gea or you don't have a goalkeeper. It's De Gea or you have another goalkeeper who's nearly as good as David De Gea.
I might suggest, actually, that De Gea last season, because, you know, we're talking, might have been a bit of an exception to what I just said, because United, I think, faced a lot of shots from good positions. But if you're the goalkeeper for Arsenal, you're not going to have enough opportunity, is the argument these people make, to be worth an added 10 to 12 points a season. It's just not going to happen because you're not going to face that many shots because Arsenal are a good team and, you know, there aren't that many more marginal points that they could gain. How responsible was he for the goals?
Well, I see free kicks time and time again, and I still don't understand, and people always say, oh, you want to leave a lot of space between the goalkeeper and the back players so that the goalkeeper can come and attack the ball. But surely if you're a defender and the ball's coming into the box, you want to be running forward to head the ball. All the coaches now get defenders to defend on the edge of the penalty box. The ball's played in behind. There's a great space to play that ball in behind, and defenders are now running back towards their own goal. And they don't always run back towards the goal, which Arsenal's defenders didn't do. So suddenly there's three West Ham players going to be first to the ball against Petr Cech. And if he stays on his line or comes for it, he's going to have a problem.
I watch this on TV and they made the point, like, the exact same point you did. You know, the defenders were too high, blah, blah, blah. But surely the goalkeeper, especially a veteran goalkeeper like Petr Cech, he decides where he wants his defenders to be.
No, the coach does it. The coach does it all the time. The defensive coach, you look at the players that are doing the holding up. It's the defenders. It's not the goalkeeper. The goalkeeper will say beforehand, the goalkeepers are wrong. This is where goalkeeping coaches and goalkeepers have too much say in what goes on. And how coaches have just followed everybody else and saying, you've got to get out the box, get out the box, get out the box. It just invites the ball to be played in between you and the goalkeeper. And you've got to be running back towards your own goal and try and head it. It's a flawed tactic. And it's not just Arsenal. Every team does it.
I mean, but the high line is for the offside as well. You think that if the oppositions leave a bit too early, they'd be offside. And it's also to leave that space for the keeper to come out.
The space is too big now.
It's easier for him to come out if there's no one around him than if the box is crowded with defenders and attackers for the other team.
I mean, if I was coaching, I'd say they'd be marking on the penalty spot. And when the ball's coming in, now they're in a position where they can attack it. You could have a line of defenders along the penalty spot and maybe two in front of them, so if it's a ball that's whipped in low, they can attack the first ball and the other defenders. It can't be worse than it is at the moment, where you keep seeing goal after goal after goal and chance after chance scored when balls are played into that area.
But I still find it extraordinary what you said, that you bring a guy in like Petr Cech, who's costing you between wages and amortization, I think, more than anybody on your team except for Mesut Ozil. He's a veteran, he's one of the very best in the world, and he doesn't get to decide or have input.
Oh, he'll have input. But in the end, it has to be the coach that decides. If I was the coach...
So it's Steve Bolt's fault.
I don't know whether it's Steve Bolt's. I'm talking about anybody, any club.
Well, no,
when I was coaching...
Not every club defend. If you're going to say that the breakdown was in the line and stuff, I mean,
most clubs do. But Stuart's right. Yeah, that is the orthodoxy. You see it an awful lot and you see it more than you used to. And it's
because what happens in coaching, everybody follows everybody else. Yeah. So it's easy to say, just get out the box. And nobody actually looks at it and says... Oh, there's one coach that I know that he's not coaching now, but he was the best coach I worked under. John, he thinks that you should defend those in-swinging free kicks like you defend corners. Two players on the post and defend it that way.
But the reason people don't do it is because it's partly because it gives you the benefit of offside, partly because it just gives the keeper more space to run into. And also there's this fear that if you don't stand on the box, you shift play 6 yards further forward. But then surely in that situation, and I'm not a coach, it's much harder for the attacking players to get any kind of power on the header because they don't have
they're having to flick it on.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing. It's almost like a flick. At the moment, everyone's saying this is the way you should do it, but it's not succeeding. Mm. Time and time again, I watch games and say, here's trouble, the ball's going to be played in there. Arsene Wenger even apparently said it, here's trouble, and the ball was played in, too much space between the goalkeeper and the back players. Back players running back towards their own goal. Some of them don't run back towards their own goal. Kouyaté gets there first.
You have to wonder, just to finish on that, Cech at Chelsea would have probably never come out for that ball like he did yesterday. Mm.
Because John Terry would have
because he knows how strong they were on defending set pieces. I think he might have realised at Arsenal since joining the club that they were maybe not as strong defensively on set pieces, and he felt maybe I should go for that because if I don't go, no one else will get it.
I think that you can't absolve Cech completely of blame. It was a very poor piece of judgment to come out for that. It was obvious. It was clear that he misjudged his run. He mistimed his run. It was poor goalkeeping. But there's maybe a deeper structural issue.
One last point on that. If
we should do an entire podcast just on how you defend set pieces.
If the defenders are defending that little bit deeper, there's not the space to hit the ball, so the cross has to be higher. Then the goalkeeper can come and catch it. But if there's so much space, that ball can be whipped in. And he couldn't come because it was a really well-played ball in.
On the second goal, despite the deflection, I thought Cech let himself down a lot by his standards.
He kind of weirdly didn't. I mean, he shifted to his left, I suppose, first, didn't he? Which was to try and anticipate the shot from Zarate. I think the main surprise for all of us was that Zarate's shot was on target. And that's a mistake. But then it was kind of weird that he didn't kind of... He didn't look like he really extended himself to get it. I don't know whether he felt he couldn't, but it wasn't right in the corner.
No.
He kind of seemed to go for it and then think, nah.
But also because the deflection, I think, took power off the shot as well. So I was kind of, you know...
But that should have been in his favour.
Exactly, yeah. That was very unchecked, like... So you say Lovichon's definitely not coming?
No, I don't think we should
take a step back, assuming everybody knows who Lovichon is. Lovichon is a tall avuncular, I think is a word.
He's not avuncular. Lovichon.
You don't find him avuncular?
No, he's kind of a vivacious character, isn't he, Christophe Lolichon?
During games, but...
He's not. I don't know if he's necessarily avuncular. I'll bow to Julien's French knowledge here.
Well...
He's not that old. He's what? Early 50s, I guess?
Avuncular doesn't mean old.
Yeah.
It tends to imply old. It means gentle and grandfatherly avuncular.
Well, that's why he is. Yeah, he is. He's very classy and nice.
I wouldn't think of him as a...
His grey hair...
No, he's not. Yeah, he's not a grandfather.
Probably not. But anyway, this guy is kind of like Peter Cech's guru, right?
Yes.
I think they first met up at Rennes. He came over. I don't think he came over straight away at Chelsea. It was after a few years.
Mm. He has unorthodox methods.
He's extremely unorthodox.
He plays with a lot of imaginary balls.
Yeah, some Chelsea managers don't like him at all, but they recognize that. But Peter Cech loves him, and he makes Peter Cech what he is. I'm just curious if... I don't want to make it seem like this guy's Peter Cech's guru or something, and he's got a chip implanted in his brain or something, but Cech tends to be a better goalkeeper when this guy's around. That's why I was curious. Didn't Arsenal...
They have already a, you know, goalkeeping coach.
What's his name?
Jerry Payton, and Arsene Wenger is very happy with him.
But they also have about 10 goalkeepers, so maybe Jerry Payton.
Have the goalkeepers always been happy with Jerry Payton?
I don't know that. Maybe
we'll
not.
Let's not pick on Jerry Payton here. We don't even know who the guy was until a few minutes ago.
That's a couple of the problems that the Arsenal goalkeepers have had, and that's been some of the things that they've said. They've not been happy with the goalkeeper.
I am curious. Well, there's other goalkeepers who've worked with Lovichon who haven't been happy with Lovichon because, you know, goalkeepers are a strange bunch. But I am curious, though. You're going to spend all this money on Cech. Maybe make sense to,
yeah.
Because I honestly don't think that Chelsea would be super disappointed, you know.
I think he's on a roll year contract as well, Lovichon Chelsea. So I think he's going to be free soon because his contract is not going to be
renewed.
Sorry, but I do think Jerry Payton is a good goalkeeping coach, and if Wenger thinks he's good enough for Sedge and Ospina and Martinez right now, then I don't think he will go for Lovichon if he thinks that he needs an extra...
Why can't they have two goals? I mean, how much do these people make a year?
Because of his methods. You can't...
You could bring Lovichon in.
Jerry.
This is the thing I always find interesting. I know, like, in other sports, you've got people who have their own sort of personal, you know, coach. Usually it's a physical trainer. I mean, at Roma, like, Totti has his own guy, and he goes and he trains with him. And, you know, kind of there's another dude who does the stuff, or two other people actually who do all the fitness stuff for the rest of the team. I'm sure if you're going to make such an investment, you want to make them as comfortable as possible. And if Lovichon's methods are so unusual that they work great for Cech, but maybe less so for the other people, I don't think Lovichon would make so much money that Arsenal couldn't afford to pay Lovichon to work with Cech and then have your mate Jerry hang out with the Ospina and the rest of the guys.
And Martinez.
Yeah.
Who's going to coach Martinez? That's the question on all Arsenal fans' lips these days.
Or even Martinez. The other big thing to come out of this game was a precociously young, tall, centre-back stroke central midfielder starting in midfield for West Ham. And we're lucky because we have a guy who used to be a precociously young centre-back stroke central midfielder.
I played in my debut was at 17. I was a bit older, 17 and a couple of weeks in the same game, but it was at Upton Park for Arsenal.
And you didn't win 2-0.
We won 2-1.
But you weren't man of the match.
That depends on
you. I'm not sure about that.
Can you just give us a tiny bit of insight? I mean, I don't know Rhys Oxford from Adam, right? Although I've seen his tweets. His tweets suggest he's an Arsenal fan. Somebody retweeted like these old tweets like... What's it like to...
It was a bit different in when I was playing. But the first thing, I knew I was in the 12 because when I was playing, we only had 12 players, 11 players and a sub. And I was in the 12, and that's all we were going to take to Upton Park. I took the train from where I lived at the time, Southend, and I pick up the back of the paper and it said public schoolboy, because I went to a posh school, is going to make his debut in the East End or a Cockney Derby, it was called. So suddenly I thought I might have a chance of playing. I turned up at the where we had our lunch. It was picked in the side at right back, which I'd never played before, to mark Alan Devonshire, who was then one of the key players, in front of 36. It was a full house. It was going to be on television. So I didn't have any nerves in some way. It was bizarre because I didn't have the build up. I was told only 2 hours. I knew I was in the 12, but I thought I'd be sub. I was only told a couple of hours beforehand. So I didn't have particularly great nerves, and I was very confident in myself in those days. So I was quite happy going into the game, and I had an experienced player in front of me, John Hollins, who was twice my age at the time. I had David O'Leary, who was an experienced player playing at right-sided centre-half, and we played very well. And we did a good job on Alan Devonshire, who was a key player for West Ham at the time. But so I can see exactly how he would have felt going into the game. He looks a confident player as well.
He's been marked out for stardom for a long time, Reece Oxford. I remember I can't remember who they were playing. It might have been Everton, and they wheeled him out in that very. Clubs don't really do it anymore. But they set up a desk on the touchline at Upton Park, and wheeled him out to sign his first professional contract, which was a really nice kind of. That used to happen all the time.
Same happened with me. Yeah. But you don't see Terry Neill was the manager at the time. Yeah, don't see it now because they're frightened of exposing the player too early.
Yeah.
But what Slaven Bilic did say, some very good things. He cannot play. I got in the team and I played every week, and it caused me massive problems 3 or 4 years later when I got groin problems, back problems, because my body probably wasn't ready for 40, 50 games a season for 4 years as a 17 to 21-year-old. He said he's not going to play every week. He's developed. He's not a 19, 20, 21-year-old. He's got to be picked at the right time. His body's not quite developed, even though he's tall and strong. It won't be developed for regular football at that sort of level. So he's got to be watched very carefully.
Really weird, though, West Ham have had probably the worst pre-season any team has ever had. They nearly lost to a team from Malta, representatives of the strongest, in inverted commas, strongest league in the world, where every team can beat every other team, nearly lost to a team from Malta. And I don't want to sort of impugn Maltese football, but I'm guessing that's not a great thing for West Ham. They've had all these players sent off, they look completely dishevelled, Bilic has had problems, then they go to Arsenal and win. Result, no one would have seen that coming this weekend. Nobody. I defy even the most...
Well, I thought it'd be 4-0 to Arsenal.
But even the most rabid Spurs fan couldn't have seen West Ham going to Arsenal and winning. No way.
Most rabid Hammers fan.
Well, they're a much more realistic bunch than Spurs fans. The Spurs fans probably wanted West Ham to win at Arsenal more than the West Ham fans did. I kind of think it's probably a bit of an exception.
You know what I like about Reece Oxford? Sorry, I saw him playing with England in the under-17. Did you do that? The 17 European Championship, which France won, by the way. And he played well. He didn't look incredible. You know, he played well. He didn't look fantastic.
He played centre-half, didn't he?
But he looked like he was the boss. And I thought on Sunday, he looked like he was the boss, although he was only 16. He asked for the ball. He shouted on people who mispassed the ball. There's one chance they showed you on Match of the Day as well where, he got the ball back and Sako got the ball and he followed continued his run and Sako lost the ball and he was not happy with Sako and shouted at Sako for not passing him the ball. And when you're 16 and you're able to voice and be so commanding, I think it's a great quality. More than his height, more than his vision, more than everything else.
The hardest thing, if you're a centre-half, which he mainly is, the hardest thing is to go and play in central midfield, because when you're playing at centre, everything's in front of you. You know, don't have to worry about your awareness in behind. You see runners and you go with it. When you're playing in midfield, the game is much, much quicker. It gets played around you. But he seemed to show good composure, good awareness of what was going on around him. So that was the good part from Reece Oxford's point of view.
Sigurdsson. Ball picked up by Shelvey. He clips that one over the top and Gomis is in. Goes round Courtois and is taken down. Michael Oliver gives the penalty and he's reaching for his pocket as well. And Courtois is going to be in trouble here. It's a straight red card.
Chelsea and Swansea, the champions. It finished 2-2. I guess the big talking point was the Courtois sending off. There's no issue. It was the right decision. Was anybody... making a face.
No, interesting.
Because they said on television that he got it spot on.
I was there. I think it was a red card, but I think I can understand why Mourinho felt that Cahill might have been in a position to cover. I think it was the right decision. Well. You could see why Mourinho maybe thought, well, in another circumstance, it could have just been a yellow. But for me, it was the right decision.
But the biggest problem with that, again, is it's not the goalkeeper's made a poor error, but the two centre-halves. It's one ball over the top, trying to squeeze up for offside. It shows a flaw in Chelsea's defending at the moment.
Yeah, but if Willian is not covering everybody. Yeah, yeah, offside by 2 miles. Why is Willian doing there?
But the two centre halves, if you know that you can't just turn your back and say that he doesn't count. You've got to see runners. What's the situation? I've got to get several layers.
The Willian thing, this is what always gets me about, you know, you compare it to, for example, sports in the US, right? Mm. After the game, you can actually go and speak to the players, you know, crazy concept. I wanted to ask Willian, what happened? You know, because I don't know why he was there.
He covered for Ivanovic, no?
But you can push up a bit and cover. You're still supposed to do it in coordination with the other defenders, right? And I would, and maybe there's a very valid reason why he was where he was, right?
Or maybe he switched off. Yeah.
But I don't know. But I would love a situation where, in all serenity, we could ask Willian, que pasó? What happened, right?
But this, we'll go.
And the guy said, if he says I switched off because I'm human and made a mistake, that's fine. If he says, look, you know, I was tracking him and this happened and that happened, that's fine. You know, I don't understand when we left here to sort of speculate that this and that, like, you know. The dude, something broke down. It's not a big deal. It happens, right?
Absolutely. But again, everybody believes, you know, I hear people talk on the on TV. I hear people talk in when they talk about back fours. The fullback should never be behind the centre halves. Whoever said that? You see, people that are actually saying this don't understand the theory of holding a high line, dropping off at the right time.
Are we going to make him name names about who says this?
Well, lots of pundits do. Lots of
name them.
They've never coached, and I played once at right back, and David O'Leary
was it on your debut?
Wolves. No, it was against Wolves, and they had a good winger, and they kept on hitting big diagonals out. And as they're back to David O'Leary on the other side, I kept on running up for offside, and I had to be in a good position. And I went in at half time and said, "This is just ridiculous. You know, how can you try and play offside?" But the coach went, "No, you've got to run up with them." Just unbelievable. And I still see it happen. How can a fullback be on the cover? You hear people say now, and coaches say, everybody say, fullbacks need to be round on the cover. Well, you can't be round on the cover if you're standing 5 yards in front of your centre-halves. You can't be round on the cover in that position. So it has to change. The theory of defending has to change. It's still all wrong. Right.
But you see the theory of defending. I mean, as far as I know, in other countries, this is the only country where I've heard people have that discussion. I mean, it seems that, like, in a lot of other places, people have kind of figured out
I think Arrigo Sacchi, he was the one that knew the theory of defending. He was the one, and other people take it on, but they don't quite know why they're doing it. They've watched an Arrigo Sacchi video and say, oh yeah, what you got to do, you squeeze up and you push across and you keep in line, but they don't actually know why they're doing it.
The other basic point too with the fullback is that the fullback can look across the entire back line, right? So obviously if he's further up,
if the centre halves run up at the last minute, he can't react quickly enough to that.
And he's not used to, you know, it's Willian we're talking about. And I know Mourinho made him improve a lot on his defensive duties because that's what Mourinho's wingers do apart from Eden Hazard. But if the guy was there right back, he probably had he doesn't have the awareness.
And I think
he's
tracked back to start with.
Yeah,
then the ball's been gone the other way. So now he's looking. And suddenly the centre halves think, oh, well, I'm not going to defend the space in behind. And he's caught out.
And to be fair, Jonjo Shelvey has, like, all the time of his life to do that pass. And there's no pressure from Matic and Fabregas. And I think the whole game, Matic and Fabregas were either tired or something, but they never put pressure enough.
Big problem for Chelsea is Fabregas. It happened at Barcelona. They weren't sure where to play him. He cannot defend. And if he plays in a two alongside Matic, and I watched it when he went back from number 10 to a normal position in the Community Shield, Arsenal's midfield just kept on running off the back of him. He doesn't want to defend. It's a major problem for Chelsea.
He was the problem he had at Arsenal as well.
Yeah.
That, you know, he was playing in that two and can't defend.
I think you guys are being kind of mean about Cesc Fabregas. I mean, he did all right when he was with Gilberto Silva, no? And Patrick Vieira, no?
Well, yeah, no. I just think
he was more determined to defend in those days.
All right.
And he had other good defensive players around him.
All right, we're going to stop this criticism of Cesc because it's making me uncomfortable because some of us actually like the guy. And I want to throw this forward to this business because, all right, I was going to say, we're picking on Mourinho, but it is pretty extraordinary, the business with Mourinho and Eva. Eva Carneiro is
Chelsea's
doctor.
It wasn't just Eva. It was the there's two people who are on the pitch. There's Eva.
Can you describe the situation, please? Right.
Stamford Bridge, a balmy summer's evening.
August 8th, 2015.
What time was
it? What time would it be? Like seven-ish?
Yeah.
A man with salt and pepper hair and a surly disposition screamed at a woman and a man. And basically, Eva and the other doctor went on the pitch. As Hazard went down, Eva and the other doctor went on the pitch to treat him. And Mourinho felt that that was a lack of, in quotes, understanding of the game, because he felt Hazard's injury wasn't serious. As soon as the medical team go on the pitch, the player has to come off and then return to the pitch, which meant that Chelsea, for at most a minute, had, instead of 10 players, had 9 players, only 8 outfield, which he felt was both a blow to their attacking intent and put them at risk defensively. So he shouted and screamed and raged at the little sort of scene unfolding in front of him as it happened. I think initially Hazard felt he was being shouted at.
Yeah.
It later kind of...
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Urged that Eva and the other doctor were being shouted at.
And you saw it on TV as well, and you heard it from the press box, because the press box is so close to the benches.
And Mourinho, he made the complaint in the TV interview, and he then reiterated it in the interview that he does for the Monday newspaper. So it was obviously something that looks like it was something that he genuinely felt. You can never tell with Mourinho. I'm not sure whether he was using it to distract from the fact that he was unhappy about the performance of his team. There's a chance, and this is pure speculation, he could have actually been shouting at Hazard for going down too easily, but then decided it was better to pretend that he'd fallen out with his medical team than it is to pretend he'd fallen out, than to sort of say he'd fallen out with Hazard. I don't think it's serious. I don't think there's going to be a raft of sackings at Chelsea and sort of Eva's going to be out and replaced by someone who looks to Mourinho for the nod. I don't think it was the medical team's fault. I think if the player goes down and asks for medical attention, the doctors have to go on.
He looked pretty hurt. I mean... He looked like he was the end of the game. I think he got kicked a few times in the game. He looked like, he looked
Mourinho
like he was
the
end.
Make the point, though, that he's just like, oh, I could tell from experience that Hazard was fine.
He did say that, yeah.
It was such a weird story.
And it's dangerous, because as soon as you start getting into this, it's either you're kind of lionising Mourinho as a Machiavellian genius, or you're criticising him for being some sort of dastardly scumbag, and it's neither. He did sort of implicitly criticise Hazard for going down too easily.
Mourinho has been spending the last 12 months saying that Hazard, we need to protect Hazard. Hazard get kicked out too much. And when he's on the floor, Mourinho said, hey, just get up and get on with the game.
I don't understand why he went and talked about it after the game, though. Like, that's the part I don't get. Because obviously, you guys could all see him screaming. I'm sure you asked him about it. And he could have just said, just something that happened in the course of the game, not important, and move on. And then if you really have a problem with Eva or with Hazard, then you take them aside and you read them the riot act in the dressing room. But it just seemed curious to me to bring this into the public domain.
That's where you get into the thing about with Mourinho, and it's not, I don't think it's reading too much into his actions, but you always wonder with Mourinho, why is he doing something?
Is he trying to deflect from the game and how poorly his team played?
Or in this case, is he trying to deflect from the implied criticism of Hazard for going down too easily by kind of overcompensating and criticising the medical team? That's
like
the
when he had
theory.
A go at the fans last season, when he had that...
Yeah.
Incredible rant at his own fans, saying like, they're not good enough, blah blah blah, and then apologise. And he's going to apologise in 3 days' time, saying, shouldn't have shouted at Eva and the other dude. And
to talk a little bit about Swansea and Gary Monk, because we sit here and we talk about the annual miracle that renews itself at Swansea and just how it's an extremely well run club. I thought Jefferson Montero just was man of the match for me.
I gave him man of the match,
and I was struck. by how last season he seemed to be sort of intermittent, and how another club might have said, meh, you know, maybe, you know, we're paying this guy a good amount of money, maybe we move him on or whatever, but, you know, they looked at him and said, you know, we think year two is going to be better, we think there's going to be a settling, and that doesn't happen very often because we often write people off.
We've got a lot of players in those positions, haven't they? They've got Dyer and Routledge. So they, when somebody has a little bit of off form, if Montero goes off the ball, Routledge comes into the side. The same on the other side, Dyer. They've got a lot of players that can play in those sort of wide areas.
It was injury as well with Montero last season. He had a lot of sort of niddly little injuries that sort of delayed his momentum. So I wonder if Munch thought, right, if you don't have a full season going at it, you can show what you can do. But one-on-one, not many better winners in the country.
He's ruined one player in Callum James, isn't he?
Yeah,
Arsenal, you know, who was in the England squad as right back. He got in front of Nathaniel Clyne, got absolutely murdered by Montero at
the 2-1 defeat.
Never and really recovered.
Did the same to Milner at right back for City.
And who do you think's trickier, one-on-one? Montero or...
Sorry, and Andre Ayew as well. No, it's not about all about Ligue 1, but Andre Ayew I thought was really good. No, he was really good on Saturday. Let's be honest. You know, he was really
playing on the opposite side.
Yeah, playing on the right hand side. But, you know, Chelsea's fullbacks, Azpilicueta and Ivanovic, I think they could be in trouble this season.
Azpilicueta did okay next time.
Azpilicueta also came from Ligue 1, of course.
Yeah, he did.
Yes, of course.
He had a great spell at Marseille.
Ligue 1, best league in the world, full stop.
Ivanovic went to Paris and visited the Louvre a few years ago.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. French connection there. Pretty obvious one, too.
Do you make a point about Swansea?
Yes.
Gary Monk went to Chelsea with Ki Sun Yun, who, by the way, is also an excellent footballer, and Jonjo Shelvey in central midfield. No holder midfielder. Dropped Jack Cork. Ki went off injured after 40 minutes, so he had to bring Cork on, and Cork did really well. But not many coaches will be that brave to go to Chelsea without a proper holding midfielder.
You don't think he is a holding midfielder?
No, I think he's more attacking than a natural holding midfielder. He can play there, but his first thought is to go forward. But Monk said afterwards that the reason he did that was to send a message to his own players to say, right, we can go to these grounds and we can play. So quite a courageous thing to do, not to shut up shop. He'd obviously decided if we get beaten, we get beaten. Season starts properly next week. But to use that occasion to say to your own players, this is a place where we can go and do our own thing, I think is incredibly praiseworthy.
Right, moving on to our debate for this season. It's our first podcast of the season. I don't want this to be sort of the free-form thing where we just talk on forever, so I want to get your predictions in and out of the way. I'm going to start with Julian. Your predictions for the top four, please.
Chelsea, Arsenal, Manchester United and Manchester City.
Yeah, that's imaginative. That's my four, too.
It's my four as well.
I'm afraid it's my four as well.
You realise that those...
Great debate, lads. Let's move on.
No, but it's interesting because those four clubs are the only clubs to have won the Premier League in the Premier League era, except for that other club that's now in the Championship.
The
Chicken Club.
The Crisp.
Chicken. Benkies.
Yeah, right? It used to be Crisp. But...
No, what?
Jack Walker. No, he's not a Crisp guy.
He doesn't own Walkers.
That's Leicester.
It's close enough.
I was baffled by that. I had no idea what they were talking about.
Julian would get it wrong anyway.
So the only issue with these four is the order that they finish in, right?
Yeah. Mm.
Anybody think Chelsea won't win the title?
I did go for Arsenal in my pre-season predictions for the paper.
Just to wind up Stuart.
Theoretically, I should stand by.
What happened? You just said it was Chelsea were going to win it and Arsenal second.
When? No, I said that. I said the same four. Right. I didn't mean the same.
Oh, order. Sorry.
I think Arsenal could win it. I don't think Chelsea. Chelsea certainly won't have it as easy as they did last season.
Presumably think Chelsea will win then? The two.
Yeah, I do.
I think Chelsea will win.
If Chelsea don't buy more defenders? If they don't sign Baba or Stones or some other dude, really looking at like Nathan Ake coming in and?
They will sign more players.
It's not that they need to sign players, and they're in quite a tricky position because Mourinho likes keeping that first team so solid and so consistent. That if they sign Baba Rahman,
then they have six defenders last season.
But will he play? Does Mourinho, if Azpilicueta's fit, he showed last season that he'll just play Azpilicueta every game.
Baba Rahman comes from Augsburg.
He does.
And if he comes, he'll get a big wage increase. He'll get to live in London. I don't think the guy cares. If he spends one season at Chelsea, plays or not, he's still young enough, he can move somewhere else. Yeah. It's not... Plus, Terry's a year older as well.
Well, that's the issue.
At some level, you're going to have to...
At some point, and it's not happened yet, there's no signs of it, but at some point, John Terry's going to go. And it may be... there's no sign of it yet, but it could be this year, it could be next year, it could be 5 years' time, but at some point, he's going to go.
Fundamental question is, who's going to retire first, John Terry or Totti?
I think both of them will outlast Bruce Forsyth.
Yeah, I imagine they probably will. Relegation?
Bournemouth, Watford, and I'm going to go, not just because of their performance on Saturday, I think Sunderland are a team that have been on the brink for quite some while.
Not a fan of Dick, huh?
No, yeah, I think Dick Advocaro has done a good job over the years, but on that note, but I just think Sunderland have got problems at their football club. It just seems as though over the years they've just scraped through. They've got a lot of players that have been there for quite some while that someone like Lee Catamol, who they keep saying is their leader and their inspiration. I keep seeing him get booked and not play particularly well. They're a club on the downward spiral.
I think you've made me laugh, Dab. I think I went for Norwich, Leicester, and
Leicester,
Bournemouth. But I've got to admit, and this is that stupid. So I'm going to stick with them because otherwise it makes a mockery of the whole making stupid predictions thing. But I do think Sunderland potentially have a problem, and I also think that with Bournemouth, there's been this whole kind of Eddie Howe's great, they play great football, it's all wonderful. We've all kind of bought into the romance of the story, and it has been a wonderful story. But you do just wonder whether the romantic story may not have a happy ending. Because you look at Bournemouth's squad, I'm not sure that it. I found it strange how everyone's just sort of said, oh yeah, Bournemouth will be fine. Will they? Is there any evidence of that whatsoever?
Who said that?
That's been the general kind of tone of a lot of...
I think when people want Bournemouth to be fine.
Yeah. The fact that they came top last season, that they were the best side in the Championship, everyone thinks, well, they've got a better chance than the other two. But the other two, well, Norwich have got players that have experienced the Premier League.
And getting Watford, relegated in the Premier League before, yeah.
Of course. Yeah. And Watford have spent quite a bit of money, so you don't really know too much about Watford at the moment.
To be fair to Norwich, they kind of got jobbed in their game this weekend against Palace. I mean, they
play with a better side.
Definitely,
some
crappy refereeing decisions as well. When it
the Cameron Jerome high foot was ridiculous. I mean, that basically outlaws volleying.
It does.
It's extraordinary.
I don't know. I think that referee needs a talking to because
it was no good stuff for referees in the Premier League.
Well, but everybody praised Michael Oliver, right?
Yeah. Oliver did well. Thought Oliver did well.
Your relegation candidates?
I keep Bournemouth. I think Bournemouth will stay up.
Really?
I really do, yeah.
Despite the fact that these players who I'm not familiar with.
I think they made good signings. I think they were very clever in the way they did their business.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you just answer me? I'm not being funny now.
I think Max Allen-Grader is going to score goals. I think this time...
You think Max Grader is going to be a difference maker?
Yeah, no. I think he will do well for them, yeah.
Based on
the fact that he's a good player, that he knows the league, that you know he's been very good since winning the African Cup of Nations. No, I think he's going to be a good
sign. He knows the league?
Well, yeah, he's played for Leeds before. He plays in England before. He knows the football here.
Not the Premier League, he doesn't.
No, not the Premier League, but I think he knows the football.
The Premier League is the league of late goals. It's intensity.
True, but no, I keep them up. I think they stay up. I think they surprise people.
Oh, we used to call it the league of late goals. When was that?
Watford, Norwich and Sunderland.
Interesting fact, actually, before 1992, in all of foreign football, no one had ever scored after the 80th minute.
Premier League story. Okay. I always imagine that there's usually somebody who we think that, because they did relatively well last year, we kind of forget that they start this season from zero and things could go really, really badly for them.
Oh, yeah, it could.
And
I don't know, I
would throw out somebody like West Brom, for example.
Tony Pulis never goes down, Gab. That's written into the
Yeah, exactly.
It's in the magnet counter.
And the other thing with, and I'm not saying just because it's down Pardew, but so many people are on the Palace bandwagon because of the way they finished the season, and obviously they made great signings over the summer. But I just wonder, it's still Alan Pardew, right? He still has horrible runs. He still has issues with people. And then he goes really, really well again.
I think it's really interesting with Palace that, you're right, there is definitely a bandwagon. And signing Kabay, huge statement of intent, great, great sort of coup. But then
he comes from Ligue 1.
Also from Ligue 1. But then you see that Damien Delaney's still in their team, and you think, all right, maybe we should all just, to use the 1990s term, take a chill pill.
As promised, it's time now for some quick hits. It took a peach of a late Coutinho goal for Liverpool to take the 3 points at Stoke. Brendan Rodgers called it, quote, an outstanding collective performance. Ollie Kay, writing in The Game, begged to differ a little bit. Rory, are you more in the Brendan camp or more in the Ollie Kay camp?
It wasn't an outstanding collective performance in the sense that it wasn't very nice to watch, but I think that there were certainly positives there in terms of the solidity of the team, in terms of the way they resisted Stoke, although Stoke didn't actually really land a glove on them for vast swathes of the game. It was very much, it looked like a first game of the season, but I think in Lovren and Stoertle, the way they performed, there are signs that Liverpool have improved in that area. I mean, I wouldn't say they're going to be title challengers. Lovren was actually okay the last four, obviously apart from the 6-1, but Lovren was okay when he came back into the team end of last season. He did all right.
Okay, enough Liverpool chat. Kyle Walker's weird own goal means Tottenham go down to defeat a United. Stuart, it wasn't a great game from a neutral's perspective, but did you see anything in Tottenham's performance to suggest that this season will be better than last season? When, I remind you, they finished fifth.
I don't think they'd be better than last season. I think we saw some good closing down. They made it difficult for Manchester United to play. They went there with confidence. But I still don't think they've got that real creativity. Harry Kane, they're going to rely very much on him. Eriksen, his creativity. I think they're going to end up fifth or sixth again. I didn't see anything in the performance I think that's going to get into them into the top four.
Maybe I'll actually give Moussa Dembélé a run and let him make a difference this year.
Higher up the field. Dembélé often plays as a holding midfield player when he plays. So play him higher up the field. That's where he played for Fulham, and that's where he was dynamic for Fulham.
Tottenham's opponents, Manchester United, had Sergio Romero starting in goal, and no fewer than three senior keepers, David De Gea, Victor Valdes, and Anders Lindegaard, hanging out together on the bench. And if those, for those of you who didn't see it, you should see it. There's a great picture of the three of them with Roy Hodgson sort of like, kind of photobombing in the corner and
in the director's box.
Well, yeah,
Victor, on the bench.
Yeah, and Victor Valdes is wearing, everybody gets to wear sort of the club outfit. Victor Valdes is wearing some random blazer
as well,
which I thought was
Victor
kind of fun.
Have you seen the picture of Chancel Mbemba turning up for the Newcastle game in a tuxedo?
Yes,
yeah. amazing. Victor Valdes trying to went for a more lounge version of that.
Miss more,
but more to the point, is Romero, who of course played in Ligue 1.
Yeah, well,
good enough, or did he sat on the bench in Ligue 1? Is he good enough to keep going for United? Now, the reason I go back to this is a brief statement for people who don't quite know this, and you really should know this, but he's a starting goalkeeper for Argentina at the World Cup, at the Copa America. They went deep in the tournament. But the dude at club level, he couldn't get off the bench at Monaco, and he couldn't get off the bench at Sampdoria last year. What's the problem with him? Is he good enough?
We don't know. No one knows. No one can tell us now, yes, he's good enough or no, he's not, because he hasn't played club football for 2 years. So I think he deserves the chance, because I think, you know, he's a good goalkeeper. But if he's good enough or not, we'll have to wait a bit more and see. Because
we didn't play club football because he wasn't good enough. It's not as if...
Well,
like,
yeah, he was not good enough for Sampdoria, not good enough for Monaco in the last two seasons.
Is and the good people who beat him out were Subasic and Viviano. And it's not like so he had like Neuer Courtois and Neuer, yeah. Yeah, as you said.
So, you know, I think he deserves a chance, though. Everybody deserves a chance, and then we see. But no one can say now if he's
will good United sign another keeper if De Gea goes?
Yeah.
Should they? Should?
Yeah.
And they will?
Yeah, they will.
And it won't be
Sillison,
right?
You know, it's just, if they're listening, just there's a good French...
It'll be,
yeah,
but it can't be Sillison. Why on earth would they don't sign Sillison?
I listen, the Sillison thing is
just weird. It's Manchester United. If Manchester United sign Jesper Sillison, that will be the weirdest transfer of the summer.
Goulouris. They're signing Goulouris if De Gea goes.
Does that explain maybe a little bit why he wasn't in goal for Spurs?
I don't know, but the great thing Spurs did is putting him on the bench so he could have a bit of the atmosphere. This is a good stadium. I would like to play here. Nice red shirts. Yeah, why not?
Everton are held by Watford 2-2. Rory, you can either praise your mates, the Pozzos, or you can comment on Roberto Martinez and call him Martinez and talk about his complaints about Stones being tapped up by Chelsea. Your call.
I'm going to go for the Watford thing, although not the Pozzos, although they've obviously been very busy in the transfer market. I'm interested in Kike Sanchez-Flores, who is he's the victim of perspective. So Kike Sanchez-Flores kind of fails, in inverted commas, like Valencia and Benfica. And then he comes to the Premier League and everyone goes, oh, well, he's not good enough for Watford. He couldn't take Valencia into the Champions League or win the Portuguese title with Benfica or whatever. That's not the same thing as being able to say that he can't survive in the Premier League. The Premier League's not that good. I think they've got a good coach. I think they've signed some good players. They have signed too many players. I think they'll be okay, Watford.
Speaking of newcomers, Bournemouth are edged at home by Aston Villa, 1-0. Stuart, I find it very difficult to tell if these guys have any chance of staying up, mainly because I didn't watch the Championship last season, and I'm unfamiliar with many of their players. In fact, I think I know more people who work for the club than I do players. What did you learn from Bournemouth in their match against Villa?
Well, I'm the same as you. I haven't seen too much of Bournemouth over the last couple of seasons. But what you did see was that they played good football. And what I mean by good football, they passed it well, but they also passed it with penetration. They created opportunities. They played at a decent tempo. They tried to win the ball back. And they dominated much of the game against Aston Villa. But they had a problem when the ball went into the penalty box. They didn't take their chances. They didn't get on the end of crosses when they came in. And, of course, they gave away a sloppy goal. It was the ball came in. Gested is good in the air, but he wasn't really challenged. It was an easy header for him in the end. So they had a problem in both penalty boxes. Up until that point, they looked a good side. Are they going to be strong enough to stay in the Premier League? I don't think they are.
Newcastle and Southampton battled to a 2-2 draw, but George Culkin, who was there, said he felt a buoyant atmosphere, and presumably he's referring about Newcastle because he could presumably cares less about Southampton. Julian, is that down to the inspirational leadership of one Steve McLaren?
I'm not sure how much he inspired them. He couldn't even make the phone work between the director's box where he was watching the game and the bench, so he had to go down. But, you know, he brought more energy and more organisation, I thought, at the back. They defended, you know, quite well, I thought, despite conceding two goals. But it must be a change for the fans and the players to have a real coach there instead of John Carver, who's a lovely man, but not really a coach.
Marcelo Bielsa walked out of Marseille on Saturday night. I can't decide, Gab. Is he a genius or a fraud? And bear in mind that whichever way you answer this, people are going to shout at you.
Exactly. I can't quite decide either. It's one of those things where you wonder, a bit like what you're pointing about before with Mourinho, where you wonder, like, is this part of some sort of calculated plan, this behavior and the way he acts, or is it just the way he is? I thought it was extraordinary to go to decide on Wednesday you're going to quit, supposedly, to then act as if nothing happens because you don't want to interfere with the game, to play the game, to lose the game, to then go in the press conference and ask and answer all these stupid questions, you know, run-of-the-mill post-game questions, and then at the end say, oh, by the way, I'm resigning. And you're supposedly doing it for out of respect for the media, who no doubt are cursing you at that point because you resigning is a much bigger story than why you lost to Khan. I find it absolutely extraordinary. But Julian, I want to get you in this. I get the sense that Bielsa was actually very convenient for Marseille because they let six starters go. They replaced them with a bunch of duds and people like Lassana Diarra, who didn't play last season, and Abu Dhabi, who I don't believe played last season at all, and a bunch of no-names. And yet you knew with Bielsa there'd always be a full stadium and enthusiasm would be the story. So I get this feeling some people have spun the tale that maybe Marseille were kind of taking Bielsa for granted a little bit.
Well, I don't know, because he was part of the recruitment this summer. You know, they bought the players he wanted.
He wanted Diaby and Diarra.
They're the only two that the club offered to him, and he said yes. And he, you know, he even spoke to Lassana Diarra to convince him to come to Marseille. But Javier Moncillo.
Lassana Diarra was in Moscow at freaking Lokomotiv, where he didn't play a single game. Presumably, the man was unemployed. He's 30 years old. With all the love in the world for Lassana Diarra, are we really to believe that he had millions of other offers?
He had a few other offers, yeah.
That were more appealing than Marseille?
Yeah, that were more well-paid than Marseille, for example,
what?
More money.
Like what?
Well, he had a few things in more exotic
in the
leagues.
Golf. Yeah, okay.
I believe that even in England, I think some people were interested in him. So, you know, so he was really part into the summer. It's not like they didn't involve him, which he felt was the problem last summer. And he had to go at the chairman back in September saying, like, you know, I gave him a list with players. He didn't sign any of the players I wanted. This is unacceptable. And we thought at that time that he might quit. But instead, he gave it a good go. They had a very good start of the season. Then they crumbled up in the last 4 or 5 months of the season. They finished fourth. The objective was in top three. They finished fourth, but it was still great, I think, for Bielsa to be there and for Marseille to have Bielsa. I think the two were perfect for each other, but you knew from the start he would end up like that. You knew he would end up in tears, and it's exactly what happened. I think two things. One, they were surprised of the timing, because it's a wrong timing, let's be honest. Two, he
said... You might
say
it's Pulis-like or O'Neill-like.
Yeah, exactly. He says that... So on Wednesday, the Wednesday before the game on Saturday, he had a meeting with the people at the club, not the chairman, but other people at the club. They tried to change the contract he had agreed with the club. They tried to change clauses and details of that contract.
Minor details, according to the club chairman or president.
The club saying actually that he...
Dave's going.
That the club felt prisoner of his request, that he demanded stuff that, you know, were too much. So I think one day we will know the truth, because right now we don't really know. Vincent Labrune, the master chairman, is using some media friends
to send his message through the press, and Bielsa is using some people as well to, you know, to put his side of the story out. So we don't really know right now what happens, but I think it's a real shame for French football that he's gone.
Smart money suggests he could be in for the Mexico job. October 10th, Mexico and the U.S. Big playoff to qualify for the Confederations Cup. You know that thing England never play in?
Yes, that's the way to hurt English football, Dan, to remind him, to remind him that it's never in the Confederations Cup.
It's all sour grapes, isn't it?
So what was the answer? Is he a genius or a fraud?
Yeah. Maybe he's a flawed genius.
Honestly,
maybe.
If you judge based on results, his results are just really terrible. I don't see how a team can... They had 41 points in the first 19 games last season, and they had like 26 in the next 19.
Yeah, but is that not...
He coached Argentina at the 2002 World Cup, and he managed not to get out of the group stage. Yeah, he did fine with Chile, took Chile to the World Cup, but then the minute they go to the round of 16, they play somebody serious like Brazil in 2010, they lose 3-0. He's won two titles in the last like 25 years. One is was in 1998 in Argentina with Vélez Sarsfield. And, you know, let's face it, Argentina, like, there's a lot of rotation. And the other one was the gold medal at the 2004 Olympics. Something else England won't be winning for a while. Many, many thanks to my guests today, 67% of whom went to non-state schools. That would be Rory K. Smith, Stuart Robson, and Julian Lawrence. I'll let you guess who who's the state school government-funded guy is, and obviously it will be the French guy, obviously. Now, we're back every Monday now until the season's end. You can press that subscribe button if you like, if you haven't already. Members will get exclusive football, rugby, and cricket highlights free as part of your subscription. And if you're not a member yet, you can take our £1 digital trial today. Just search Times Sport Online, and hopefully we'll be with you all season long, through the autumn, through the winter, a lot of winter, and then the spring as well, right up until the summer. Take care. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
What?
Why did you name all of the seasons?
Why do you think?
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.